This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
after the constitution is amended, Burundi will be more stable, and because this new constitution promotes democracy and fights impunity.
That's Nancy Mutoni, in charge of communication for Burundi's ruling party, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Yusuf. Details coming up.
Also, the UN human rights chief is worried about more violence linked to Burundi's contentious constitutional referendum. And Somali officials say heavy fighting has erupted between Somaliland and Puntland forces in a disputed area.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: Burundians head to the polls Thursday to vote yes or no on proposed changes to the constitution. The ruling party says the changes are aimed at shaking off vestiges of colonialism. The opposition says they are designed to extend the president's term in office. Mohamed Yusuf reports from the capital, Bujumbura.
Campaigns have ended in Burundi, and now both sides are hoping they will carry the day come Thursday. The East African nation has been stuck in a political crisis since President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for and won a third term in 2015. In defiance of critics who said he was violating a two-term limit in the constitution, the government says to avoid another dispute, the constitution must be changed. The proposed amendments will change presidential terms from 5 years to seven and, in effect, allow President Nkurunziza to run for two additional terms, potentially keeping him in power until 2034. They will also allow the ruling party the power to fire an elected member of parliament who is found to be breaking the country's laws and constitution. For a bill to pass the legislature, it will need the approval from a simple majority of lawmakers, compared to 80% in the current constitution. Nancy Mutoni is in charge of communication of the ruling party, CNDD FDD.
After the constitution is amended, Burundi will be more stable, and because this new constitution promotes democracy and fights impunity, and it gives the people the voice. Their will and wishes are in the constitution, so they will have more trust in the institution more than ever, because before it was discussed elsewhere. It was discussed by politicians only, not the people were not consulted.
The 2000 Arusha Agreement and the 2005 Constitution brought an end to Burundi's civil war, which claimed the lives of more than 300,000 people. The Arusha Agreement was designed to reconcile Hutus and Tutsis and ensure the groups share power. The International Federation for Human Rights said Tuesday that the proposed constitutional changes threaten to upset the balance of power and peace the country has enjoyed in the last decade. Agathon Rwasa, a former presidential candidate who is urging Burundians to vote no on Thursday, says the changes will generate instability.
These amendments, if it could be adopted, will just generate more troubles in this country instead of stability. So we'd better look forward and try to get laws which are there to respond to the general interest of a nation, not just for the sake of a group of people or an individual.
Rwasa and his team have complained of harassment and intimidation during campaign period. Diodine Beshirahishize is a member of the Burundi Bar Association and council member of the East African Law Society. In Arusha, it was agreed for the laws to change. The country must be in a state of peace and stable. But if you look at the current situation and the environment, this referendum is being conducted. It is conducted in a state of fear and intimidation. People cannot express themselves, and those who oppose the constitutional changes are getting killed. Human rights groups have blamed the ruling party youth wing known as Imbonerakure of attacking, intimidating and killing opponents. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
The UN human rights chief is worried about more violence linked to Burundi's contentious constitutional referendum after armed men attacked a village, killing 26 people. The motive was unclear for the attack Friday night on the village of Ruhamagara, 60 kilometers northwest of Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. But UN Human Rights Chief Zaid Rad Al-Hussein says it came at a time of rising tensions in a country awash with rumors about the effect of the referendum on Thursday. Among other things, the ballot could extend how long President Pierre Nkurunziza stays in office. He warned that everyone will suffer if Burundi explodes into violence during or after the referendum. Al-Hussein urged the government to provide peace, security, and a fully functioning democracy while telling the opposition to avoid actions that could add fuel to the fire.
Mental health in Liberia is being brought to the forefront through programs and training supported by the Carter Center, created by former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. The center, based in Atlanta, Georgia, works in more than 80 countries to resolve conflicts, advance democracy and human rights, prevent diseases, and improve mental health care. Liberia, still recovering from years of civil conflict, also survived the world's deadliest Ebola outbreak. The virus took the lives of more than 3,000 Liberians. More than 4,000 survivors now live with the physical and mental scars of the disease. Their friends and neighbors also struggle. Dr. Janice Cooper leads the Carter Center's Mental Health Initiative in Liberia. In the second part of our look at mental health care in Liberia, she spoke with me in her Monrovia office.
It's trauma on top of trauma. So we went through a civil war, and people were barely kind of getting back from dealing with that. And still some people have a hard time dealing with it. And then Ebola comes, and it just exacerbates the trauma. I always tell this story about right after Ebola, we were declared Ebola free, and we're back in class, and we had our first class after Ebola. And we do a meditation at the beginning of each day. And people kind of talk about what are the important things in their lives from a perspective of well-being. And the students started talking about Ebola and the impact that had on their lives. With everybody that shared, within less than 15, 20 seconds, they moved from talking about what happened with enemy Ebola to what happened during the war. It was a seamless kind of transition back to prior trauma. And it really helps us to understand what unresolved trauma looks like. And it's not that trauma doesn't reoccur if you're someone that's had a lot of help and a lot of support, a lot of therapy, but it's more likely to reoccur and morph into other things when you have not had any resolution of all of that pain and all of that emotional pain and all of that heartbreak. I mean, people saw their relatives butchered in unspeakable ways. And then to have something like Ebola happen, where you don't even get, in some cases, to see the corpse of your relative. And Ebola itself is such a violent death. If you were there to witness that, that was also something that you want to erase from your memory.
How did you initially go about putting together a program to help with the psychological aspects of war and Ebola?
When we first started working to address the psychological health of persons affected by Ebola, we worked closely with the response team, so the first responders in particular. What we found are high levels of alcohol abuse. We're now also screening for drug abuse, but at the time we were mostly focused on alcohol abuse and high levels among the burial teams of alcohol abuse and of trauma. I mean, they would tell you stories about how they cannot look at fresh meat anymore, because it reminds them of their experiences during Ebola. Compound that with these kind of major events, which are traumatic, and then you see how difficult it is for parents, for family members living or have experienced trauma. Even worse if you're a person with mental illness. So in our setting, they are probably treated the worst.
How challenging is it to treat someone with a complexity of psychological trauma, such as coming out of a civil war, then on top of that, the Ebola crisis?
Many people don't really understand mental illness. They attribute it to witchcraft, attribute it to something that your ancestors did or you did. So We have many persons living with mental illness that have this extra stigma of people not going around them, people not supporting them, them not being able to find a job because of the stigma. So a lot of things to get through.
How will the passing of Liberia's first Mental Health Act keep mental health issues in the forefront in Liberia?
The law mandates treatment for persons with mental illness on par with persons with other kinds of conditions. The law mandates that you can involuntarily commit someone that is a danger to themselves or others. All of these things were not in the law before. The law mandates a review committee so that people's rights are not taken advantage of. It mandates a review committee that's made up of experts in mental health and are made up of people that know about both treatment as well as assessments. The law also requires the government to provide mental health services. And so we have a policy, but we actually have a law that will allow advocates, will allow mental health service users to take the government to court. The deputy minister, he's the chief medical officer, did go on the radio to say one of the things that the law is mandating is that the ministry provides services to people when they need them.
That was Dr. Janice Cooper, project lead for the Carter Center's Mental Health Initiative in Liberia. We spoke during a visit to her office in Monrovia.
Past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Today marks the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. For Muslims, a period of fasting, reflection, and communal gatherings. Muslim Americans of diverse backgrounds and national origins will gather in Islamic centers across the United States to worship and celebrate their faith. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi has more on Ramadan in America.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Muslims in America observe Ramadan just like the rest of the Islamic world with a set of traditional rituals. Families shop at halal meat stores, prepare iftar meals to break their dawn to dusk fasts with family and friends, pray together, and help the poor. Shakir Sayed is the Imam of Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Virginia, which serves a Muslim community from 42 different nationalities.
Those who come from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds, we all speak English, so we use English as a unifying language. And we do all the activities to accommodate everybody, especially in Ramadan.
Shakir says, the center provides Muslims free meals to break their daily fasts and organizes nightly prayers during Ramadan. While Muslim Americans are fasting during the day, they are surrounded by non-fasting colleagues at work. For Egyptian American Ibrahim Radi, that's not a problem.
I have to fast because it's my duty to fast. It doesn't matter what everybody else is doing.
However, his wife Nadia misses the big family gathering in Morocco.
There's a big difference here. You don't have extended families. So instead of having like 10 people around the table, there's only the two of us.
The work day can seem even longer for Muslim Americans performing their religious duties during Ramadan. Amina Tambouche is originally from Senegal.
Everyone will cook some food and bring it. And we all eat together and we pray together and we talk about Muslim religion, you know, teach each other. And at work sometimes we go to pray together, like around lunchtime.
For Muslim American groups, Ramadan also has served as an occasion to educate the American public about the religious observance and the Islamic faith in general. That includes open houses at local mosques and Islamic centers, public lectures on Ramadan, interfaith iftar dinners, and TV ads reminding the public that Muslims are an integral part of U.S. society. Imam Shakir Sayed says his Islamic center invites Christian and Jewish Americans to iftar dinners every Wednesday as a way of interfaith dialogue during Ramadan. Interfaith dialogue thrives during the month and helps to better understanding among followers of different faith, as Keith Ellison, the first Muslim American member of Congress, explains.
It's a critically important dialogue for us to have. All people of all colors, all cultures, and all faiths need to come together to talk about points of difference so we can discover how we are unified.
Since the early 1990s, U.S. presidents have issued Ramadan greetings each year to the more than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide. Imam Shakir Said believes the presidential greetings have helped to raise awareness among Americans about the month of Ramadan. Muhammad Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Somali officials say heavy fighting has erupted between Somaliland and Puntland forces in a disputed area in the Sul region. An official in the region told VOA the fighting is intense, with each side accusing the other of setting off the clash outside the village of Turkarak. It sits between the main towns of Las Anud in Somaliland and Garawe in Puntland. Both sides report casualties, including deaths from the fighting, but numbers could not be confirmed. Michael Keating, special representative of the UN Secretary General, visited Puntland and Somaliland over the weekend and urged de-escalation. But tensions continued to rise as a military buildup intensified. Observers say continued fighting can only deteriorate the humanitarian situation in a region prone to recurrent droughts. The central government in Mogadishu has called for a ceasefire respecting the Islamic holy month of Ramadan.
South Africans are being asked to name the grocery items they think should be exempt from the valued added tax. Earlier this year, the country increased its VAT rate by 1 percentage point to 15%. The existing list of 19 VAT-free food items will remain in place to shield the poor from the increase. But that list dates back to 1993. And after much criticism, it is now being reviewed. From Johannesburg, Nadia Sami has the story.
Mealie meal, pap, rice, legumes, brown bread, milk, and vegetables are all staple foods in South Africa. They're among 19 items that carry no VAT. The aim is to assist poor households, but other items are in for a VAT hike. The Treasury's list of foods subject to the tax has come under criticism, so the Treasury is calling on the public to submit suggestions for additional exemptions. 69-year-old Jennifer De Vries receives a state pension. She's critical of the current VAT-free list, which has been unchanged for 25 years. She says in that time, people's diets have changed and the list should reflect modern healthy lifestyles. These are some of the items she would like to see on the VAT-free list.
Chicken, meat and fish. There's a lot of things that we have to do without, and we also have to eat vegetables. Instead of making a meal with chicken or that, we have to make extra sacrifices now.
She says she's had to change the way she shops since the tax increased by 1 percentage point to 15% earlier this year.
You know, when you say 1%, it seems like nothing, but when you walk into a supermarket, you can immediately see the difference in prices. And I really don't know how people are going to survive. I don't know how they do survive. People with children, how do they feed them? What's going to happen to them?
Portia Tupe is a mother of two who battles to make ends meet with her wages as a domestic worker. She says the government is out of touch with the needs of the poor.
I don't think they've done much research about that, because all they knew is what we have been buying from the store. They could see that this is how much the customers is on demand, so they decided on their own to put that on a non-vendor tax. Yet there are more basic needs for us black people, mostly when you go to the shop and buy some certain things, then when you see that the money that you had is not enough.
Economist Kaya Sitole says the list has always been contentious. He points out many processed items on it form part of a wider manufacturing value chain, which includes aspects that are in fact taxed.
We are now confronted with a question of whether the list should be expanded, firstly, to include more foodstuffs and perhaps more importantly, whether it should include non-food items. So on the basis of the current list itself, is that the goods that are mentioned there themselves are not perfectly insulated from the effect of a VAT increase. So if you look at a loaf of bread, for example, all the inputs being the flour, the water and the electricity are themselves vettable at the standard rate, which is now 15%. So obviously, if the input costs into creating a loaf of bread have gone up.
Sithole says this ultimately means the price of bread will go up, even if the increase is not labeled as a VAT increase. Sithole also notes that meat is not on the zero-rated list, despite it being widely considered part of a balanced diet.
One would then have to look at the question of whether even our understanding of what makes up the staple diet of poor people is as complete and as thorough as it needs to be. Because you might find that, for example, meat itself, which is currently charged VAT at 15%, probably merits an inclusion into the zero rating basket if it is regarded as part of the staple diet of the poor.
The finance minister has appointed a 9-member panel to review the current list of zero-rated groceries. It must report back with recommendations by June 30th. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
Women demonstrators in Nairobi have marched on a restaurant that allegedly asked a breastfeeding mother to cover up or breastfeed in the bathroom. The women say restaurants and other facilities need to support mothers who choose to breastfeed in public spaces. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
What is so offensive about breastfeeding that you would send a mother to the bathroom? This was a question posed by women taking part in Tuesday's march from Nairobi's Freedom Corner to Parliament and then to Olive Restaurant in downtown Nairobi. It was at this restaurant that 26-year-old Beth Njeri says she was humiliated by a waitress for breastfeeding her baby. It was early afternoon, Njeri stepped into the restaurant with her 16-month-old daughter, Alisa, and ordered some food. Njeri explained what happened.
My baby did not settle. She was moving, she was trying to start, so she was disturbing and moving all around. I took her and started breastfeeding her so that she can be calm because the order took some time. When I was still feeding her, a lady came and she told me to cover up or stop breastfeeding. So I stopped breastfeeding and I gave him some question. If there is somewhere I can maybe breastfeed well. So she lowered her head toward the washrooms.
Njeri was angry and in her rage posted a description of the incident on her Facebook page. The post was picked up by members of other groups and quickly went viral, with mostly women jumping to her defense and even planning Tuesday's march. Njeri says that she was shocked by the response from her post, but was glad that the incident has sparked a national dialogue on breastfeeding.
Women should breastfeed anywhere, maybe even in public places, because you can't even choose where the baby will want to breastfeed. It's natural.
Kenya's parliament is considering two bills that will mandate safe and convenient spaces for lactating mothers. Both would require employers to set aside special areas for breastfeeding mothers in the workplace. Nairobi County Nutrition Coordinator Esther Komboka marched Tuesday in solidarity with the mothers.
Every public space that holds more than 30 people is supposed to provide a breastfeeding space. We expect our organizations and all our public spaces in this city to be able to provide breastfeeding spaces for our mothers.
Meanwhile, the eatery has issued an apology to Njeri via its Facebook page and appealed for calm while it deals with the matter. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lina Ormudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss addressing neonatal sepsis, a bacterial infection in the bloodstream of newborn babies. For your questions or comments, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.